Hello and welcome to the Space in Between podcast. I'm your host, Lee Morgan. This podcast is for listeners who are fed up with the hyper-polarized nature of the world today and who crave spaces where current events can be discussed in constructive, enlightening, and delightful ways. Let's get started. There are some people whose work doesn't just inform you, it recalibrates you. Well, Sherry Mitchell is one of those people for me. Sherry is an Indigenous attorney, activist, wisdom keeper, and teacher from the Penobscot Nation. She's also author of Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change, which, full disclosure, is probably the most bookmarked book that I have on my bedstand. I read it in 2018, and it really has had a profound impact on my life. Sherry's work lives at the intersection of ancestral wisdom, legal and political reality, and spiritual truth-telling. One of the things I appreciate about Sherry is that she does not offer easy answers or abstract ideals. She invites us into right relationship with ourselves, with one another, and with this beautiful planet that we live on. And with so much of modern life that is pulling us away from each other, she says, let's reconnect. And so I felt that this was exactly the conversation I wanted to have today, because one of the questions I keep returning to personally, spiritually, and in terms of how to lead effectively is this: what does it mean to stay human in a dehumanizing time? So we're going to dive into that together. Sherry, I'm so honored for you to join me today. Welcome to the Space in Between podcast.
Lee, thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to be able to be in conversation with you again. If you'll indulge me for a moment at the beginning, I just want to do an introduction in my own language to acknowledge my lineage and where I come from. It's good to ground yourself in your place of home before you venture out into the world, before we take this off and into new worlds. That would be helpful for me.
Yes, please.
Kwe Pasidawan, hello everyone. Andaliwisi Wanahamugwasit Danajio Banawabskewi. My name and my language is Wanahamugwasit. I am Bear Clan from the Penobscot Nation and Crow Clan from the Passamaquoddy Tribe at Zibayik. And I'm very happy to be here with you today.
Thank you for that grounding. And I come to you, as you know, from the ancestral homelands of the Coast Salish people here in the Pacific Northwest. So you are in the far northeastern corner of the United States, of that nation state, and I'm here in the northwest corner. So I'm glad that we are kind of rooting ourselves in a different coastal territory. So thank you for that. And you and I first met, I think, in 2018, when we were both engaged with an organization called Neotero. I was part of the team there, and you were part of our Indigenous Advisory Council. And one of the things that struck me first from our engagement by Zoom, and then we've spent some time together in space, and your passion for building a better world and for lifting up Indigenous wisdom in the ways that elevate both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. Well, it's very inspiring and impactful. And my question for you is, where does your passion come from?
Well, I mean, it comes from my upbringing. It comes from growing up in a very strong Native family during a time when our rights were being negotiated actively within our tribal nation. I came up during that time when our tribe was actively fighting for our rights in the courts of the United States. And so the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Agreement was reached in the year 1980. And so it was really during my formative years when everything that I was hearing outside of my home in the community, but also directly inside the home and family members who are actively involved in that process, were really about our rights as Indigenous peoples. And then also growing up in a state where there are 5 tribal communities here in Maine, but it's a very white state, where there is a pretty significant degree of racism. that still exists to this day, had a powerful impact on me. When I was a young girl, there were young men from the local university who used to come into our community and grab young women off the streets and rape them and throw them back out of their car at the bridge that was the entrance to our reservation. My brother got shot in the leg at 10 years old while he was tying his shoe just for being native and being on the opposite side of the bridge from our reservation in on the mainland. And then there were a group of young men from our community who were in ceremony at this place that's of ceremonial significance to us that were attacked by members of the Ku Klux Klan and were hospitalized. And so those were all catalyzing events. You know, the juxtaposition of real racial violence and then this really dignified representation of our rights as human beings was in my image as I was growing up. And so I was kind of steeped in that tea, and that really ignited a passion within me for addressing some of these issues that keep us from seeing the humanity in one another and prevent us from being able to show up in our most humane form in the face of, you know, shared challenges. And so it was a fruitful time for me, a very fertile ground to have grown in.
That is, and the fertile ground, of course, infused with the racism that you mentioned, and that's so much a part of, you know, remains here as a part of our sadly cultural traditions and as part of our many of our systems and structures here. And I recall a story you shared with me about, I think it was connecting with your grandfather, who had shared with you a bit about your path and what that was to become. And can you share a little bit about your name and what you learned from your grandfather and how that led you to the work that you're doing now?
My name was actually, when I was a small child, I was given another name by my family. And then the name Wenahamu Gwasit is a name that I was gifted by ceremonial elders when I came into adulthood and was ready to be given the role that I was to take out in the world. And so that was a result of, you know, decades of watching me become who it was I was meant to become and seeing things in me that I had not yet been able or willing to see in myself. And so Wenahamu Gwasit is an aspect of a being within our mythology who's a white feathered serpent. And this particular aspect is the digging beneath the surface and bringing the things that are hidden to the light. Wenahamu Gwasit also chases the sun down into the darkness and back up into the dawn sky. So it's really about the name directly translates to she who brings the light. It's about bringing things to light. And so that name was given to me, and I had to go through a process of then coming to accept the responsibility of carrying that name. And I mean, throughout this process, the two spiritual elders who fasted for that name and gave me that name were not biological relatives of mine. They were spiritual relatives of mine, that part of my ceremonial family. And my grandfather had always implied, in some subtle and some not so subtle ways, that that was to be my path in life, and really taught me how to trust in my voice, to trust in my knowing, to be able to stand by my convictions. So, to make sure that what I was standing for was something that I felt very values aligned with, in order to maintain a sense of respectability in that stand, and to not compromise my sense of human dignity based on the inhumane treatment of others. And so, I feel like his influence was teaching me how to be that person in the world and to stand in that way in the world because I watched him stand in that way himself.
Well, let's lift up your grandfather and your spiritual teachers and guides who helped pull out that name for you, right? Which is something help you connect with that. And certainly your life is such a testament to that. And it reminds me of one of the core messages that I took from your book, Sacred Instructions, which is this perspective, I think, really about the dark and the light in our world right now, that on one hand, we have these polycrises, you know, that manifests at political levels, at a community level, and in organizations and institutions. But one of the things that you've been very clear about is that at a deeper level, societies everywhere are dealing with spiritual and relational crises. And can you unpack that a little bit, and particularly related to this notion of how do we stay in our humanness at this time of polycrisis, and but dig deep at the spiritual level?
And I'm assuming, since you know me, that we're just going to dive right into the deep end of the pool.
Always.
And so the moment calls for a considerable amount of maturation of our species. And so we are living in these tension points right now between being required to level up in regard to our emotional intelligence. We are managing the grief of collapse of the paternal structures that have been caring for us and that we have been dependent upon. And we have been required to act quickly to address the collapsing systems that are falling down around us. And then we have the polarization that's caused by different ideological approaches to managing all of those things. And so we have this multitude of personal growth that we're being asked to manage simultaneously with climate change, increased levels of violence on the planet, real issues of scarcity, supply chain problems, political rhetoric that is leading to real physical harm and danger for people across the planet. And so we have all of these multiple tensions that are pressing upon us right now. And one of the catalyzing points, which is something that I just actually this morning was editing a chapter that talked about this very, very thing in the new book, is understanding the difference between independence and interdependence as we're moving out of this dependency status of colonization. And so what's going on right now is we're moving from our spiritual childhood into our spiritual adolescence. And so, this spiritual childhood has been characterized by prescriptive ways of knowing. We've been told what to believe, prescriptive ways of being. We've been told how we must behave in according to these certain strictures, under this real paternalistic control of this patriarchal colonial systems. And so now we're in this stage of transitioning between that childhood into a more adolescent stage where there's more autonomy, more freedom of thought. That also comes with a greater degree of responsibility and accountability, which we're seeing all of this playing out on the public stage with these outbursts, fluctuations between childhood and adolescence, where, I'm screaming for my independence, down with all of this control and this paternalism. And then the second we take away your allowance, we're in the streets screaming for our services to be returned because we're not quite ready to be grown up yet. And so, we're seeing all of these flips and flops back and forth. And this notion of moving away from dependency, some people see that as a move towards independence, which has been a real aspirational goal of our society. Like, we have a society that's been formed on ideology, almost a religion of rugged individualism. And when we have a society that's formed on that type of fierce individualism, we also become more susceptible to autocracy because, that independence is associated with I'm going to make the decisions on my own as a matter of pride.
Yeah, it means it's like an identity of like that's the end in of itself, but you use the word interdependency.
Right. Interdependence is different than independence. And so if we look at independence, independence really actually, if we're moving from the state of dependency to independence, we're in trouble, right? Because there is no species on the planet that has ever independently survived. There's no species on the planet that has ever been truly independent from all of the other species. Every species, every form of life lives in a state of interdependence where we are reliant upon each other. And so that represents a state of mutual care, shared decision making, cooperation, collaboration, all of the things that we see in a healthy democracy. And so if we transition towards independence, we're transitioning toward autocracy, where there's individual rule If we transition towards interdependence, we're transitioning towards a more collaborative democratic state of mutuality and cooperation and mutual care. And so, this is where we really want to be moving, is towards greater interdependence, where we then take responsibility for the systems of care that we're developing for one another, rather than being dependent on this governmental or paternalistic power for that care. We start learning how to care for ourselves and one another in emotionally mature ways and socially mature ways.
And I love how you're framing this because it strikes me that we're in a transition time of
Absolutely.
kind of, in a way, hospicing an old paradigm
Right.
while also midwifing, ideally, this world of greater independence, greater mutuality, greater responsibility. I would say also greater accountability,
Absolutely.
not
Yeah.
just for ourselves, but the communities we are part of. And we're in this kind of messy transition period where I think there is a lot more suffering in the world. There are groups, marginalized groups, tend to bear the burden at these times. And we're certainly seeing that of Black, Indigenous, people of color, undocumented workers, and then, whole groups of people in parts of the world, right? That where we see genocide and others. So there's a lot more suffering. And so with I think more suffering and climate change, it's tempting to gravitate to a charismatic leader, right? Who might say, I have easy solutions to you. Those people are bad. We're not. Come with me. And what's the spiritual practices that you want to invite us to be aware of? And for the Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, what's this spiritual piece here that we need to keep in the front of our minds and on our hearts?
I think the spiritual piece is tied to this very thing, because I think that, the original sin epoch that we're operating under right now is this notion of separation. It's a belief that we are somehow other than one another, and that we are other than other elements of the living world. And so, this is where we are living right now, is under this illusory ideology and separation. And so it really is about navigating this illusion of separation and moving ourselves out of this, because it's not just that we want a charismatic figure. What we want is somebody who's going to tell us what to do. Like, we want that childish reassurance of somebody's going to take care of this for us. Someone's going to tell us what to do. It's terrifying to think that we are now responsible for the decision making and the path making going forward. And it's also terrifying that we have to be held accountable for the harms that we've caused. I mean, this is part of that maturation process, right? And we are in the soup, we're in the thick of it right now. And so, really learning how to let go of this idea of separation and reconnect with one another, reconnect with the living earth, bring ourselves back into alignment with the thread of life, the whole spirit of life that we have separated ourselves from, is the spiritual work of our time. We have to let go of the prescriptive illusion that tells us that we are separate from one another, that tells us that we are something other than, that tells us that we have no power and authority to be able to dream and vision and co-create, actively co-create, that we are trapped in a world that's predetermined, even programmed like a video game is an illusion of childhood as well. Like, we have to take responsibility for our role as active co-creators of the future that we can collectively vision together. I mean, that's the spiritual work of our time, as we're navigating all of this growth simultaneously. So we really have to learn how to parent ourselves and one another through this very difficult stage of growth. And one of the things that I talk about a lot in Rise Wild, which is the title of the new book, is really looking at these multiple stages of rites of passage that are embedded into Indigenous cultural and traditional ways of being, where there's an understanding of where we are developmentally that gets translated into active practices that help give us the tools for navigating those things and moving through to the next stage. And in this colonial reality, much of our cultural teachings from across the world. You know, this whole melting pot ideology is a stripping away of cultural value, which is where all of our moral and our ethical teachings are held. And so if we're having that stripped away, we lose our compass on how we move forward, right? And how we move forward in relationship to one another and to the rest of the world. That is the nexus of the work that we have to be doing.
Can you share for listeners a little bit more about when you refer to indigenous worldview? And I will say worldviews, right? Because there's
World views.
views, plural, plural, plural. There's such heterogeneity amidst and among indigenous identified peoples, et cetera. Not unlike anywhere else, but I, as someone who's, non-indigenous, trying to learn, it's so important to start from that place of many different worldviews. And yet, one of the things that I think is so powerful about the worldviews that I've had some exposure to through our colleagues that we've worked with and being in territory with some indigenous peoples is there's a substrate that does connect across the many diverse expressions of indigenous worldviews, and that is actually interconnection and I would say non-separateness, right? As distinct from Western mindsets, which really does posit man's dominion over nature, right? And then that follows along into conquest and, colonizing. We as a people are better than you as a people. Can you share a little bit more about indigenous worldviews and what you would want listeners who I would say are majority non-indigenous who haven't had the benefit that I have and others of understanding why there's a starting point that's so different for most indigenous worldviews?
For us, there's a phrase says Ndilna Bamako, Pisilda Ndilna Bamak. It's a foundational understanding that I am related to all other elements of life. And you'll hear a lot of Indigenous people, this is the commonality, say some version of for all my relations at the end of a talk or a prayer or something that they're putting out into the world. And that's a recognition that I know that I can't take anything or ask for anything or give anything or speak anything or create anything, imagine anything without it impacting all other living beings because we are so deeply interconnected. It's a recognition of this concentrism, right? It's a concentric way of knowing and a concentric way of being in relationship with life and with one another. And so for me, what that equates to is having never been kicked out of the garden, right? We've never been made to believe that we are something other than the rest of the living world. And so that's a foundational difference in understanding. We're not having to undo this ideology of separation in order to find our place in the larger living world. We are already humbly place ourselves within the larger living world as co-equal beings, not in dominion over, not stewards, none of this manifest destiny language or master of ideology. It's really about being a co-equal being with all other beings, human and non-human alike, in the living world, recognizing that we are the youngest species and we have the most to learn. I mean, human beings have only been here for 300,000 years. And of the nine other humanoid species that have existed on the planet, we are the only ones to have survived. And so we have this illusory belief, right? This arrogant belief that that makes us wise. So we call ourselves Homo sapiens, right? The wise beings. But yet we have a great deal to learn. And that kind of hubris is also very childlike, just like the, king of the hill ideology, like, this is mine. No, this is mine. And this is mine. And this is mine. And this is mine. And I do it myself. It reminds me of my 3-year-old grandchild. And that kind of ideology doesn't lead us to the place that we want to be. There is this woman who's non-Indigenous, Frances Moore LePay, says, why are we actively co-creating a world that none of us would choose to live in individually? And I think that this is the thing, is that we become so tied to these ideologies. We define ourselves in relationship to them to the point where it prevents us from actually growing. Now we're being pushed by this evolutionary impulse to move out of our childhood towards this adolescence And we're being asked to do so in the midst of polycrisis. So this is a really powerful and profound test for our young species. There's a great deal that we have to ground ourselves in. You know, how do we stay human? One of the things that I tell students who are in my classes and in my fellowship programs is we have to think about learning in terms of a wheel, right? So we have a wheel. If we think about a tire, as our consciousness is rising, it's coming up with the tire. And then we have this moment of like awareness here on the top. And then we move into practicality, right? This practicum of our learning. And it goes whoop, we start going back down, right? So, and then we get to this place where we're hit the ground and we're squeezed in between the ground and the tire. We're in the dark. We're feeling all this pressure and this tension. It feels like we're in this moment of retrenchment where we're being pulled back, but then we're catapulted forward. So we're in that moment of retrenchment, trapped beneath the tire and the ground right now. There's a lot of analogies for this. So if we think about it in terms of like a wave ebbing and flowing, when you're standing in the surf, if your feet aren't rooted into the ground as the waves come in and out, it's going to knock you over.
You're going to feel pretty unsteady.
Unsteady, you're going to feel like the world is shifting around you, and chances are you're going to end up in the surf. And so, one of the things that we can do during this time is to really ground into the values and the understandings that we have developed up to this point. We have evolved our consciousness to a great degree, right? I mean, we know a lot of things that we didn't know. Here you are as a white woman of some privilege having a conversation and seeking the guidance of an indigenous person who grew up on the reservation. You know, maybe 25 or 30 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. It definitely probably wouldn't have happened 50 years ago. And so we have learned to see one another as human beings in a different way. We have learned to work together cooperatively to solve shared problems, to come up with, solutions that meet a larger whole than just our own little tiny universe. There are a lot of things that we have been able to accomplish in regard to technology and medical advancements and, a whole number of other social, political issues that we've made progress on. But when we're in that stage of moving through this progress, there's always a stage of holding on to the old, being afraid of what the change that the new is bringing. And we're in the normal retrenchment period where we've made a degree of progress. Now there's that fear aspect that's trying to pull us back. The only way that we prevent that from happening is by rooting our feet in the values that we've already established. And so, compassionate awareness, a more holistic view of understanding of one another, the humanization of those who are different rather than seeing them as a danger. We see them as an opportunity for our growth and expansion of our consciousness. We've done a lot of this work. We have more to do, clearly. But in order to keep moving forward, we have to not lose ground right now, which means we don't panic. We bend our knees, we root our feet in those values, and we stay grounded while the wave pulls back. And then, when that tide moves forward again, we move with it.
That is so powerful. And so the metaphor of a tide and a tire, I think, are really rich because the tire metaphor, ideally, tires move you forward. You know, if it's on your bike or your scooter or your car, so there's this kind of constant tension, and then some relief. And then here we go again. But the metaphor does call us to move in a forward direction, which links with your evolutionary framing, right? From child to adolescent, which I think is very poignant. And it strikes me that just as those of us who are on a wave, some of us feel more rooted and a little less shaken by when the tide goes out, and others are kind of, whoa, I'm pulling out. So we're at different stages, each of us as individuals. And to be honest, I feel like sometimes during my day, I'm at the bottom of the tire, and then other times at the top. And so there is something really important about managing our own kind of emotions, dealing with things that are realities of challenges from paying our bills or not feeling fearful that this war is, ridiculous and what's going to happen next.
Right. I mean, I feel like that's something that I really am talking about in this maturation chapter on really looking at what are the emotional skills that we need to develop in order to be able to manage that. Because, the rites of passage ceremonies, let me see if I can find this section. I have part of it right here. So when we look at like our puberty ceremonies, one of the things that we're being taught is how do we gain control over our rapidly shifting thoughts? The ways that our thoughts are moving so quickly during times of transition and growth. And how do we then learn to manage the storm of emotions that those thoughts create? So the correlation between our emotions and our thoughts, and having to co-regulate those two things with one another, and developing ceremonies that help us to both self-soothe and self-regulate. And I think that the important piece of this is that these are not skills that are taught regularly in the mainstream society, that there's some expectation that people reach adulthood with the skills and the abilities needed to be able to manage the difficult transitions of their lives. And if that were true, then the estimated $50 billion that was spent last year on self-help workshops and books and products could have been spent on feeding the hungry, housing the homeless, dealing with other social needs, education, healthcare, right? But because we're reaching adulthood without those fundamental skills in place, many of us are feeling ill-prepared to manage the complexity of emotions that are required. We're also having to surrender our autonomy to machines that don't have compassionate awareness, that don't have the ability to think in nuanced ways and to discern. They don't have an ability to humanize situations and individuals. And so, because we're so overly taxed with the avalanche of information that's being dumped on us, right? The complexity of technological advance, the increase of social reach that extends beyond the capacity of human beings to be able to process. Like all of that has increased, but our ability to process hasn't changed, right? And so, how do we manage all of that madness with all of the other things that we're going through? We have to really increase our mental, emotional, and spiritual capacities. And I mean, that's something that we can actively engage in processes to develop. All of our fellows that come here, and even our staff, we give them emotional intelligence and resiliency training.
Yeah, and tell say when you say we, the organization, just
The
so folks.
Land Peace Foundation. Yeah. So my organization is the Land Peace Foundation. And, we provide that training. We also just hosted a series called Divided We Fall, where we brought people together from different political parties, from the activist universe, from religious communities, and had a discussion, right? Really wondering why anyone would rather have an enemy than a conversation, right? And that's a quote from somebody that I can't remember who it is. It's not my quote, but I love that idea that why would anyone rather have an enemy than a conversation?
I think that's so powerful because even that statement leads us to a different story that we tell ourselves and tell others.
Absolutely.
And so much with this podcast, I mean, I learned so much. I get to talk to amazing people, and then I'm doing solos, which are really helpful for me to crystallize learnings or insights that I have really informed by so many. But one of the things that we need to do, and I think you're lifting this up, is connecting around places of shared interest or values. And you mentioned that, a few minutes ago, right? That we have some shared values and being compassionate. And at the same time, we can do that and hold people accountable for behaviors that are harmful. The reflective feedback that I get is like, well, this isn't about everyone just holding hands and saying
Absolutely not.
you're good, I'm good, et cetera, because that's a kind of a paradigm that I think lets us off the hook.
It's a bypass fantasy.
It's a yeah, well, wow, that's powerful. Yeah, and so it's like, that's not what we're talking about. I think what we're talking about and what you're inviting all of us is to say we must find a way to not be divided, but with that process comes a lot of accountability also.
Yeah.
For holding ourselves and others accountable. How do you walk that thread around bridging divides, saying no to polarization, but also when people do have bad behaviors, how do we manage that?
There's an element in here that's really complexly. I think that one of the things that we have to reckon with is our ideas of right and wrong and good and bad and black and white, that one of the most interesting things that I think is happening right now is that we are so overwhelmed by the horrific things that are being brought to light right now that have been made possible under the current paradigm, the dying paradigm, the paradigm that's dying, that we're actively moving beyond, is all of the stuff is coming to the surface for that accountability piece, right? There's a need for responsibility to take responsibility for the harm that's been created underneath that system before we move beyond it. And so all of that stuff is coming to the surface. And one of the things that I think that we do is we misplace responsibility in those situations. There's no way to soundbite this and meaningfully address it. And so I think that's the piece that we need to really be careful of, because we've learned how to soundbite really complex problems to the point of making them immaterial. And I think that when we soundbite significant crises into immateriality, we prevent ourselves from the opportunity that they present to actually dig out the wound, get rid of the poison, and begin to heal it. And so we can't do that if we aren't willing to take personal responsibility and accountability for the roles that we've played in the perpetuation of the systems and structures that have allowed for that to persist. And so that part of it is not something we want to do. We want to just say, no, it's those bad people over there.
It's so easy to do that, and yet it reduces to sound bites when what we really want are stories.
We want stories, but we also want the opportunity to grow ourselves, because we are the people who are going to be walking into the future that we hope to create. And if we want to be capable of living in this utopian future that so many of us are dreaming of, like, you have this spectrum of realities that is really been carefully curated through virtual reality and artificial intelligence, right? So we have this spectrum of realities where on one end there's a utopian fantasy of one moment of peace, one moment of unified agreement that it's going to transport our entire species to a place of lasting, sustainable peace without doing the hard work of working through our disagreements, transcending them, integrating differences of opinion into a workable, collaborative understanding, which is what's required for a lasting peace. We're going to continue to be incapable of making any steps towards real change, right? And on the other side, which is just as indulgent, we have this dystopian nightmare vision that we're holding of an unchangeable world that we are powerless to shift. And so, we're operating between these two spectrums of extremes, and it's that all of that sand of possibility in between, where we have the ability to be able to craft something entirely new. And so the challenge for us is all of this composting and this death and this grief, right? So, grief isn't just an expression of love lost. Grief is an expression of something significant having being taken from your life that leaves a space that you haven't quite learned how to fill, right? It's an expression of love, but it's also that expression of the space, that creative, imaginal space opening up that you then have to step into without the familiarity of the person or the thing that you've lost being there. And so we're in the process of grieving the dying paternalistic state, because any absence of something that's been so familiar over across millennia, right? There's going to be this sense of familial attachment to it that causes grief, even when we know that it's the right thing. Every relationship that I've ever ended, even when I was the one that said, this is not the right thing for me and I need to walk away from this, I grieved. And then I had to imagine, I had to step into that imaginal space, and I had to imagine what is my life going to be like in the new reality without this person or without this job or, whatever it is that's being lost. And then take tangible steps toward embodying that new reality. So we're also orienting ourselves within that space, right? So we're going through adolescence while experiencing the death of a parent in the dying of this paternalistic system.
And it strikes me, I love how you're talking about grief because I've had such experiences of beauty, of grief as a beautiful, beautiful life-affirming experience for me. And this is kind of newer for me in my life. And it's just been so incredible for me, having gone through a transition in the last year or two, that I feel more alive now. Higher agency, clearer about what's important to me, and going through kind of the intensity of where the grief or a transition was at its highest, I was amazed that I didn't feel disabled and I didn't feel depressed. And it was kind of the first time in my life it was like, I'm just grieving something. And that aliveness has really actually given me hope that that's actually also what's happening in society. I mean, here you and I are, and this is a podcast, and you're another podcast. Anyone who's listening right now has a sense of agency of wanting to be a part of moving through the old into the new. This notion of grief has been actually personally quite liberating, and you're helping me see that in a broader framework of that we can't bypass grief as a global community. We have to go into it and through it. Would you agree with that?
Right. Absolutely. And I think the other piece that's important there, like, and you're talking about your life, your ability to stay in your truth while managing grief is a measure of emotional maturity. Let's not mystify that process, right? Let's just look at it practically and say, oh, I've learned how to go through this process of loss and grieving, imagining the new, stepping into the new, becoming something new that I wasn't before because I hadn't had those experiences. And now I can enter into that process with a degree of excitement, even while managing the grief, because I have familiarity with it. And so that's the thing, is that we have to call on that wisdom and apply it to the larger reality that we're all experiencing right now. I mean, that's the wisdom, right? That's the societal emotional maturity coming into play. We may have reached that level of emotional maturity as individuals. We need to now societally bring that degree of emotional maturity into play into the moment that we're experiencing collectively.
So helpful. And with that framing, how would you describe what effective leadership looks like, right? Because leaders are individual, we're managing our own, hopefully, evolution and our grounding. And when we're not grounded, staying in it and regrounding, really remembering and reclaiming our wholeness. And yet, leaders, we're privileged that we lead teams, we lead organizations, So there's an added responsibility with a potential for helping to amplify this societal level change. So what insights would you share about what effective leadership needs to look like or should embody these days?
I have a leadership program. One of my fellowship programs here is a leadership program. We just met with those fellows yesterday. And one of the things that I talked to them about is, if you want to think about good leadership, we really need to be thinking about this distinction between independent leadership and interdependent leadership. And so if you have a leader who's saying, I'm the boss, I'm forging the path for you, I'm not going to listen to other people's ideas. I'm doing it my way. And if you don't do it my way, I'm going to bully you and I'm going to abuse you into submission. That's not leadership. That's childlike tantrum, right? That's bullying. That's really immature behavior. That's not where we want to go. Healthy, mature leadership looks like humility, having the humility to know that you don't know everything, and being willing to cooperatively and collaboratively gather information that looks at the mutuality of needs of all those impacted and makes considered decisions using that collective shared decision-making model of an interdependent system, right? And so if we can start looking at things in that way, because it's interdependence that's allowed us to survive, right? All of the other humanoid species who have died off, the one thing that we have that they didn't have is a sense of community and cooperation and collaboration across species. And so when we're thinking about that in terms of sustainability of our lives, survivability of our species, we're in danger. Like we are precariously positioned in the larger scheme of life. The planet can heal itself after it spins us off. But right now, we're behaving in this parasitic suicidality where we are actually destroying the elements of life that we depend upon to survive. You know, when you have one energy project in the state of Utah that is going to double the consumption of energy that the entire state uses for one project, that is insanity. That is suicidal.
And you're talking about data centers, yeah, and the
Yeah, I mean,
drain.
and that is not living in right relationship with the rest of the living world. Because one of the things that's been true about invasive species across the 4.5 billion years that the Earth has existed is that they have been eliminated by the rest of the living world. And we arrogantly believe that we are somehow above that type of accountability to the rest of life, and we are not.
So prescient. Sherry, I love this conversation so much. I feel buoyed, even amidst, kind of this sense of we're at risk, right?
The
For,
enormity of it,
yeah,
right?
the enormity. And yet, I think the work in the world is to, for all of us, to find the places and spaces during our days, literally, where we can find grounding, where we can find a level of agency. To acknowledge the hospicing that we're doing, the grieving that we're doing. Literally, some of us are out there on the streets, some of us are bridging divides, whatever that work is. We're hospicing while we're also midwifing something new. Yeah.
Right. And I think that birthing process, Lee, is really critically important because one of the things that is also true is that maternal wisdom has ensured the continuation of life for every species. I mean, and that's true across the board. And if we look at what has degraded and diminished our societies and our species to the greatest degree, that has dehumanized and really taken away the dignity of our humanity, it has been the elimination of the sacred wisdom of the mother across the board. And so I feel like part of the work of this time is returning that sacred maternal wisdom to all of the places where it has been exiled. And that aspect of bringing that sacred feminine, heart-based, life-giving, life-affirming, life-nurturing, life protective wisdom back into our decision making, back into the hearts and minds of all of those who are taking on leadership roles within our society is a really critical aspect of our movement at this time because the world desperately needs the wisdom of the Sacred Mother.
So desperate, and it feels to me like a rebalancing to a natural state where sacred feminine and masculine are in balance, right? And then you have expressions of that which are super diverse and colorful and varied in different cultural contexts, etc. I do think this is so important, and you embody that, and I thank you for that and the work that you're doing. And as we wrap up our time together, I have one last question. I ask all of my guests this question is if you had a magic wand, your sacred staff, right? What is one wish you have for listeners?
I think that the one wish that I would have for listeners is a deep resonant knowing of our interconnectedness, not only with one another, but with the rest of the living earth. If everyone could find a green space, even if it was only 1 foot by 1 foot green space, where you could put your feet onto the earth and align your vibration with the vibration of life. for 5 minutes every single day and mindfully do that, reconnect in that way, this real depth of loneliness that we're all feeling would start to go away. And we would start to be able to co-regulate in healthy ways, balancing our nervous systems in alignment with the energy of life. Right now, we are being moved by this frantic vibrational frequency that is being driven by this unrelenting pace of machines that is beyond the capacity of human beings. And that prevents us from meaningfully connecting to the compassionate, heart-based wisdom that we contain. So if we could take that time every day to slow down, to make that connection, to allow that to come into our body and to influence the regulation of our energy field, over time, things would start to shift, in the way that we see life. And so I'm going to stand on the earth after this session, and I'm going to imagine that I'm connected to all of those who are listening. And if we can take time to make that connection with one another every single day, we begin to rehumanize ourselves in the eyes of one another, but we also begin the process of rehumanizing ourselves by reconnecting ourselves to the thread of life.
That's a beautiful way to end our time together. And I love that you use the word rehumanize. It's a reconnect, remember, reclaim, rehumanize with our fundamental nature, which is one of connection, not above or beyond, but just one part of nature that we are a part of. And that's that interconnection that you were talking about, of calling us through this process of waves of feeling like we're on that tire sometimes, but we are moving. I do believe we're moving ahead. And conversations like this, the work that you're doing and your colleagues, is so important. And I cannot wait to read your new book. When can we expect that?
Well, I was hoping that it would be available for pre-order by the holidays, but it looks like it's probably not going to be available for pre-order until the turn of the year. So it'll be available for pre-order early in 2027.
Well, I look forward to amplifying when that comes out, and I would encourage anyone listening today to listen and buy Sacred Instructions, your first book. It is a profound work of wisdom, and I've loved our conversation. And of course, I knew I would because I adore you. And thank you for being with us today on The Space in Between.
Wonderful to share this space with you, Lee. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space in Between podcast. If you did, please hit the like button and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. And check out the spaceinbetween.com website, where you can also leave me a message. Take good care.